Brad, you've had a long career, first on the clinical side as a therapist, and now as the head of Care and Treatment Centers. From that perspective, what are the kinds of changes that you've seen in the treatment options that are available to people who are struggling with substance use disorder?
It's a great question. A few of the things that we've seen over the past 15 years or so that I think have been important have been the evolution and adaptation, particularly for opioid use disorder, of medication-assisted treatment, life-saving adaptation of medication-assisted treatment for people with opioid use disorder, which had been around for a while, but was often kind of requisitioned to the backwaters of addiction treatment and seen as a lesser than modality, and fortunately has become much more widely accepted as the data for quite some time really showed that it was highly effective in staving off death and relapses, and has become far more widely accepted in the treatment of patients with opioid use disorder, and could not come at a more important time given the opioid epidemic that we have been dealing with. I would also say that the expanded identification of trauma and what trauma really is in the treatment of addictive disorders, going from simply looking at the things that happened to people that weren't supposed to, so PTSD type trauma, to really understanding trauma through the lens of the things that were supposed to happen to people that didn't. So complex and developmental trauma, disruptions to nurturing, boundaries, communication, and how those disruptions can really shape the way that people interpret and respond to the world and are predispose them to the development of mental health and addictive disorders. And so this much more complex understanding of the foundations of substance use disorders has allowed us to have a much better understanding of the root causes of what are fueling addiction in our patient population. And as a result of that, are able to drive our treatment approaches in a much more targeted way to get to the underlying issues so that we can create more fertile ground for people to recover. The last thing that I would say, and it's related to all of those things, is a much more integrated approach to the treatment of addictive disorders, which is as opposed to treatment being very siloed, 12-step treatment, medication-assisted treatment, spiritual-based treatment. It's really looking at treatment modalities all kind of working in conjunction with one another and using a combination of those modalities for each person based on what their individual needs are, as opposed to you just happening to get the modality that my program provides based on the fact that that's where you ended up. A much more sophisticated approach has evolved in the past decade.
Thank you, Brad. I recently read some statistics that indicated the pandemic has made life really painfully worse for those dealing with substance use disorders and other mental health issues. For example, what you were just talking about, a significant increase in opioid overdose deaths. What are your thoughts about how the pandemic has impacted the treatment programs?
I would say that in general, the pandemic has jolted the severity distribution to the right. So those that were severe are now extreme, those that were moderate are now severe, and so forth, kind of down the line. The data that you're referring to, we had a 30% increase year over year in the number of overdose deaths from 2019 to 2020. We have had alarming increases. Hundreds of millions of people have now, more people have now identified with anxiety and depressive disorders worldwide. We actually think those numbers are pretty low because we know that the data coming out of the developing world is not the greatest data. And it's not surprising. the things that we needed to do over the past couple of years, socially distance, we had displacement, economic uncertainty, financial worry, we had family displacement. All these things are exacerbating factors for mental health and substance use disorders. And what we will see is that as the pandemic becomes endemic and there is a return to a newer normal in the months and years to come, these mental health and addictive problems that manifested, unfortunately, are not going to have been acute, largely. They will have become chronic for many of these people. Hopefully some will subside, but many will now be here to stay. And so as a result of that, there's going to be a renewed emphasis on the need for us to continue to have this as the number one public health crisis of our time. What we're seeing from a practical standpoint in treatment is demand is greater than ever, and the complexity of those presenting to treatment is more complex than ever. So we're seeing anywhere, depending on how you define it, between 80 and 90% of all patients presenting at Karen's programs are afflicted with more than just a substance use diagnosis. So they have a co-occurring diagnosis, they have a trauma diagnosis, a developmental or a behavioral diagnosis. So people are more complicated and they're really suffering. And so we're going to have a real, we have a real challenge on our hands today, and we're going to have a real challenge on our hands for many years to come. So the more awareness we can raise and the more resources we can muster up to help everybody, we're going to need it because the challenge is in front of us for sure.
Thanks, Brad. When my wife and I were first seeking treatment for our child, one of the things that overwhelmed me was how complicated it was, the financial arrangements with insurance and not insurance. And it was such another stressful matter that each time we had to find treatment, it became another Herculean. Is there any reason to believe that any of that is changing or happening in the right way to ease that part of this crisis for families?
Well, we hope so. So we piloted something about 6 years ago where we created a partnership with a payer, with Independence Blue Cross, on a value-based agreement with a plan here in Philadelphia that we took some risk, they took some risk on a case rate. So once a patient was authorized, there was no managed care, they come for a month, they pay us a flat rate. If they relapse within 90 days, we bring them back at our expense. And we agreed that we would try it for 90 days. We'll see how it works. And if it works, great. If it doesn't, we can cancel the contract. Well, it worked splendidly. It worked so well that our recovery rates were over 80% at a year. It saved the insurance company a ton of money. Our patients were very happy. The way that they were paying us was good enough for Karen that the patient was happy. We were happy. The payer was happy that they were willing to share the information with other payers. And we've been able to replicate that with several other payers. And so we believe that this is actually the model for the future, a model that is a partnership between payers and providers that is based on value, as opposed to adversarial relationships between providers and payers, where payers are trying to pay as little as they can and providers are trying to extract as much money as they can with patients stuck in the middle. So we have a proof of concept that actually works. And so what we're really trying to do is now put pressure on the rest of the industry by leveraging our relationships with the payers to say, this is what you need to be getting other people to follow. So that's the good news. The challenge is we're kind of the first to do it, which means we have a lot of wood to chop till we get there.
Hi, Brad. You touched on some of this in some of your answers earlier, but with this increase in the addiction rates, are you seeing more people? Is the data out there showing that more people are actually seeking treatment? And then are you able to track that they're maintaining their sobriety once they've been in treatment?
You know, it's a good question. The number of people presenting for help is staying about the same. But that data tends to lag. So we really haven't had a chance to look at that data because it's still, we're only about 18 months, not quite 2 years into the pandemic. So the look back on that's really going to be interesting in a year or two from now to see that if starting in, you know, April and May of 2020, and I think that the data is really going to be much more interesting starting in like August of 2020 when people started moving around again, is that typical 8% of people who have a problem presenting to treatment, does that number creep up to 10? Does it creep up to 12? And start to see if that number begins to move. So it's still a little bit preliminary, but there may be some other factors in there that we start to see that could also drive some of that. So there's more frictionless ways for people to get involved. So even if that does happen, we'll want to control for that. So there's a lot of telehealth platforms and ways for people who are less severe to begin accessing care. So if you're able to get into a virtual IOP and you don't have to walk through the doors and all the stigma and shame associated of doing that, it might be easier for somebody to engage. Now, who knows what your outcome is, but it certainly would then count towards somebody actually seeking help. Now, if they get the help they need and they get well, then that's great. If it's not what they needed, but it counts towards them actually getting help, well, we need to figure out what the long-term gain actually was. Is it mean that they have a bad experience and they never get help? Well, that's not a good thing. So it's going to be interesting to take a look at how this has kind of shifted the earth. There has been a huge investment in the past couple of years in the virtual health space. I think it will bring a lot of benefit to the less severe, kind of the mild at risk, maybe the mild to moderate side of the continuum and maybe to the aftercare side. But I think that kind of when it gets to that middle of the severity spectrum and anything to the right of it, it really is not going to be a substitute for the more complicated cases because you're just not able to take people out of their environment. You're not able to have the same kind of peer culture and accountability. And especially when people need medical detox and stuff like that, you're not going to be able to have the same level of safety. So it will be interesting to see. As that data begins to come out, probably in 22 and 23, we'll be watching it very closely.
Brad, since we've been in the world of recovery, I've met the most amazing treatment professionals. And I'm always struck by the uniqueness of the field of recovery that the treatment professionals are also many of them themselves in recovery. So why do you think that is? And does this continue to be the case with treatment professionals in recovery?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think that the biggest reason for that is that it is an enormously challenging job emotionally. And even those that aren't personally in recovery are usually in family recovery or have some personal connection to it through some other indirect way. And without that connection, the staying power, it's just kind of hard to have it. Because the emotional fatigue, the compassion fatigue, and the exhaustion that just comes from dealing with the defense structure that tends to come along with people who are suffering from addiction, especially the more severe manifestations of it, it tends to burn clinicians out pretty fast. On any given day, or any given week, you can spend the vast majority of your week fighting tooth and nail harder for somebody to save somebody's life than every single person is willing to fight for themselves. And that can feel an awful lot like pushing a rope every single minute of every single day. And if you didn't have somebody doing that for you and know that if that person wasn't willing to do that for you, and if it wasn't for that person, you wouldn't be there, it makes it really hard for maybe you to do that day in and day out every single year. And I think that's a big reason for it. So many people do it, they get sober, and it's part of their ability to pay it forward. And so that I think is a reason why there's such a draw to it. I know for me personally, I'll give you kind of my 2-second spiel on that. I studied psychology as an undergrad. I got out of Renaissance, kind of bounced around, did some corporate jobs. I couldn't stand it. And kind of oddly, I was like, kind of like treatment. It was interesting. I like the group therapy process and I like psychology. And I said, I think I could probably make a career out of this. And I liked helping people. And so it was kind of a confluence of I like psychology. It was different than sitting in an office all day and I wanted to help people and I thought I could do some good. And I really liked the idea that like people were there for me and were willing to work really hard to help me. And over the past 10, 15 years, it's been really meaningful to me that because, you know, a long list of people at Karen were willing to show up for me every single day, I have this amazing life. I have my family back. I have two beautiful kids. I have a beautiful wife. I have a beautiful home. I have this amazing career working for this amazing organization. And it's all because some other wonderful people showed up every single day, you know, to deal with a bratty kid who was a pain in the neck to his parents and gave him a shot. So who knows if maybe I'm giving the kid who's going to take my job someday a shot. And that makes me feel really good.
Brad, from my vantage point, there's been a lot of awareness that has developed over the last number of years. Celebrities coming out however, 30% increase in overdose deaths this year, COVID obviously, but it's still a big, 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 big issue and not going away. What do you think needs to be done by the country to successfully address this issue, both for the addict and for the families?
Well, I mean, again, I think that one of the biggest things is something that we're really trying to drive towards is, you know, we really need to mainstream addiction medicine the way that the rest of chronic illnesses are part of the mainstream, you know, medical industry. You know, it's still kind of a nascent part of it. The amount of training that nurses and physicians are getting in medical school and in nursing school is very small. So their comfort level in identifying the early signs of addiction is unacceptably low. The amount of overprescribed medications in this country is still a rampant problem. And even if you fix that today, that doesn't stop the influx of illegal drugs coming into the country. But that's the low-hanging fruit. You know, if we stop that, that starts to solve some of the problem. We need to then start educating our families. We really need to start educating parents and families on the warning signs early and often, and starting to arm them with the you know, with the types of information as to how to start to have conversations, you know, with their kids at an early age. The problem that I see happen most often is parents say, we had no idea this was happening. But within 30 minutes of a conversation of parents of a 20-year-old, they're all of a sudden saying all sorts of things that they saw a kid was 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, that they saw that there was problems. They were just avoiding the problem. And they weren't having those conversations. And to me, it's you know, there's just not enough time spent in schools and whatever forums are appropriate where this education could be happening. And so we're missing a lot of opportunities where we talk about how important this issue really is, but where are we really putting our money where our mouth is? And then I think the last part of it is the medical innovation where we can have things like the blood pressure cuff type innovations where we can now start arming our doctors and our parents with being able to know how at risk is my kid. So, you know, we have the test for the BRCA gene for breast cancer. So you can now know, wow, I'm at a 50X elevated risk of developing breast cancer because of this gene. Karen is on the precipice of getting FDA approval in partnership with another entity for a cheek swab in-office genetic test for the same thing for opioid use disorder. There's a very real possibility that we could have something out like this within, you know, the next 6 months that would be a real game changer. Now, does that mean that if a kid wants to get high, he's not going to get opiates to get high? No, of course they will. But I would love to know that about my kids, because if they get their wisdom teeth taken out when they're 16 years old and they're at risk, I'm going to say, no, no Vicodin, ibuprofen and ice. And, you know, at least I know that I can do something to try to prevent them from being exposed to something that they're at risk to. And those are the types of things that we can do on a population level to begin to stem the tide. And once we begin to do that, we start to really chisel away at that eye-popping number. And hopefully we start taking the 1980s HIV/AIDS epidemic number of deaths, and we start moving towards the 2021 HIV/AIDS number, which is, you know, significantly lower. Nobody really in this country needs to die from HIV/AIDS anymore.
Brad, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. Always love joining you guys anytime.